Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Stack Trace, the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives, with me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
Hi, John. I feel like I'm saying this every time now, but long time no speak.
Yeah, I know. I have the same feeling. It's like we used to speak so often on this podcast, like when we did episodes every week even. But now it's been, of course, a little bit more rare that we've done recordings, which I know it has pros and cons, right? Like the fact that we can't record as often as we used to. It was so much fun when we did. But I am also very happy that even though we are now doing a lot of other things, we have very busy schedules, our lives have changed in many different ways, we're still able to keep the show going, even if it's not, you know, every single week or every single month. We do have like episodes every now and then coming out, which I always love recording these episodes with you.
Same. And of course, we had to do one before the end of 2023.
Of course. And we picked a topic for this episode that I think is going to be very fun and interesting to talk about. So the topic is how we have kind of changed as developers during this year. So kind of some self-reflection going on here. So sort of what we've learned as developers and any new techniques or technologies that we've started looking into or working with, or maybe some specific technologies we've kind of stopped working with or are phasing out or something like that. So kind of just look back at the year from our personal perspectives, because we used to do on the show like these more kind of larger retrospectives about the past year, like what was the developer tool of the year or the game of the year and so on, right? But I feel like with the current kind of scope of the show and the way we're working and us more focusing on our own projects these days, it would be really interesting to just talk about from a personal perspective, right? Like what has 2023 looked like for us kind of career-wise?
Definitely. So how about you tell me, how have you changed this year as a developer?
Sure. So kind of another reason why I personally really wanted to talk about this topic is because I've tried recently, or let's say for the last few years, to be a little bit more deliberate about kind of my self-improvement, if you will, especially when it comes to my career and working as a developer, as a freelancer. I've tried to kind of more reflect back at how I'm working, what some of my strengths are, what some of my weaknesses are, and how I can address those weaknesses, or how I can kind of double down on the strengths, and how doing that can make me kind of stand out more in the marketplace, if you will.
Right.
Because I think as a developer, and especially as a freelancer, it's of course very good to be a generalist and be like generally good at, you know, the kind of development work you're doing, like whether it's like iOS development, for example, like knowing the iOS SDK really well, knowing Swift and Objective-C very well, and so on. Like those are kind of the core competencies that we need to kind of continue to work on. But then there are so many other opportunities to kind of get into different niches, I feel like, and kind of specialize yourself in different ways that can help you, you know, land that job that you wanted to land, or perhaps getting certain projects as a freelancer, or getting new customers and so on. And, you know, as a freelancer, I'm always kind of looking into that and trying to really like specialize myself in a way where I can provide good services for my clients and, you know, get new clients and work on new projects and have everybody kind of be happy. And I feel like by doing that, you can kind of also really accelerate your learning and accelerate your kind of personal development in your career. Because, you know, one thing we're looking for, I think most of us at least, is to kind of continuously improve. And a lot of that often comes down to like learning new technologies or learning new APIs. But I think there's also, for most people at least, there's a lot of room for improvement or ways you can kind of specialize and get better in kind of the way you work or the way you approach certain problems and your kind of methodology or how you kind of write your code and how you structure your code and so on, how you work with others. So that's something that I'm kind of continuously looking into improving for myself.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And it's something that I feel like most developers end up figuring it out by the time they have a little bit of experience, where if you think about it, most decisions you've made in your career that had a significant impact on your success or lack thereof are not technical decisions, right?
Right.
Those are like people decisions or like business decisions, especially if you are a freelancer or an indie developer. there are lots of things you have to be aware of and think about and decide upon, which are not technical things. Of course, the technical decisions are always very important and they can also have a big impact, positive or otherwise, but the really big decisions that will make a difference in the long run are usually not technical ones. So I feel like after you have exercised your core abilities, a developer who can develop is like the minimum you have to be in order to be a developer. So you have to go beyond that.
It's a good place to start for sure.
Exactly. So you definitely have to go beyond that.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of those things that I've been focusing a lot on recently, and especially so this year, has been to try to get really good at solving tricky bugs. Mm. And like the process of debugging, investigating issues, investigating crashes, and fixing those. And this is a thing where I think if you would ask most developers if they prefer to work on new features and developing, you know, new UI, doing cool new animations, new functionality, or if they prefer to go through the backlog and fix old bugs, I think most people would prefer the first category, right? Like developing new features, because that's where all the excitement is, right? Like it's very rare, like often in a press release or in release notes, you like the bug fixes, some of them sometimes are highlighted if they were like big bugs that were affecting a lot of people. But a lot of the times it's like, here's all the new cool features we've introduced in this new version, and then bug fixes and improvements, right? Like that last bug fixes and improvement part, it doesn't seem to be as glamorous as the new features part, right?
Definitely.
And I've definitely been that kind of developer for most of my career too. Like if you would ask me, you know, if I would give you an honest answer, of course I would prefer to work on features because that's, again, super exciting and you get to build new things from scratch. It's really, really fun. And kind of the maintenance aspect or like the bug fixing aspect is perhaps, again, not so glamorous or not so exciting. But that's something that I've wanted to change with myself. Again, coming back to that kind of self-improvement and being kind of a little bit self-reflective and thinking about how can I improve myself as a developer and how can I improve maybe, again, not just my skills, but like my attitude towards certain tasks or, you know, certain ways of working.
Right.
And I decided like a while back that I need to start embracing like not feeling like working on bugs is something that is boring or frustrating or something, but really take it as a challenge and really trying actively to get much better at it. Because most things, if you practice them, you do get better. And when you get better, a lot of the frustration or boringness or something you might associate with that thing kind of can go away, or at least it can heavily be improved. And that's definitely been my experience with this little experiment of getting better at solving bugs. So the way I approached this was, first of all, I started just volunteering in all of my different client projects I work on, in my personal projects, and when I work with other people on hobby projects and so on. I just started always volunteering to fix bugs. Like whenever there would be some bug coming up, I would say, hey, I can fix this one if no one else wants to tackle this one, especially if they were more tricky ones like crashes where you don't have like a ton of information, or bug reports that were a little bit vague, where like the user might report something with maybe some screenshots or something if you're lucky, but some description that may or may not be completely accurate depending on, you know, because it's coming from their personal perspective. And sometimes they try to maybe generalize a little bit too much to say like, this is always what happens when you tap this button, but it only happened when they were in a specific state, right? So these are typically like really, really tricky issues to solve, and especially when you don't have so much information to go on. So I just really started to volunteer to work on those things and just to try to work on those kinds of issues and those kinds of tasks as much as I possibly could. And then in my own projects, or when I work with other people in my spare time on hobby projects like game development and so on, I just started having a policy where if there is a known issue, I just always work on it first instead of working on new features.
Right.
So when, for example, we do the game development and we currently have like a closed beta on the strategy game that we're working on, hoping to have an open beta at some point next year, but so far it's a closed beta. When I get a bug report from one of the beta testers, I just put that as the top priority, kind of no matter what the bug is, because I just want to make sure the project is as bug-free as possible, number one. And then number two, I get to also, during that hobby project, also do that kind of exercise of learning how to get better at debugging. And I think the process of learning how to get better at debugging for me has been a lot to just kind of get rid of bad behaviors, if you will, or right. things that I did that were not very productive. For example, one thing that I think a lot of developers do when they investigate issues is they jump to conclusions too quickly.
Right.
And this is something that I absolutely have done so many times. Where
you're holding it wrong.
Yeah, exactly. So you see a stack trace, for example, not this podcast, but an actual stack trace. And you look at just the current stack, right? The current thread, and you see a crash, and there might be like an error message there or an exception or something. And you just immediately decide, like, this is the issue. Now I'm going to fix it. And that can be really hard and frustrating because you might not yet have enough information to actually go ahead and implement a fix. And then, you know, that can be really, really tough to do. So the first kind of thing that I started really exercising or like trying to do better is to, before I even start trying to implement a fix or experiment with the code, to really like try to get as big of a picture as I can of any single issue. So that means not just looking at the current thread in the stack trace, if there is a crash report, for example, but all the threads and the logs and looking at the device and the battery and like, are they in low power mode or what's the networking look like and so on. Like, try to just gather as much information as I can from these sessions that experience these crashes.
Right.
I even had an issue that I fixed this year where it came down to the locale that the user was using. So, you know, no information I feel like should be ignored when you're investigating these kinds of issues.
Right.
Because like, even if it might look like all these stack traces have nothing in common or they have everything in common, sometimes you can find that information that is actually going to give you that clue to solve the issue. So it's been a lot of that this year, and I've been really, really happy that I've done this exercise because I feel like throughout the year and, you know, some more time before last year as well, I've gotten so much better at this, like to the point where I actually really enjoy debugging now. I enjoy fixing these tricky issues. I kind of treat it more like a mystery where I have to just investigate this mystery and solve it and gather all the clues. And I've really kind of turned that around, and I feel like that's been so incredibly productive to the point where now I can actually offer even better service to my clients where they know that if they have a tricky bug that's been in the backlog for a long time, they can give it to me and I will actually, you know, enjoy fixing it and probably have a good chance of getting it done because I've just had that experience now and been exercising that for so long. So it's been like a really, really good experience and I'm very happy that I did that.
John Sandel, the Sherlock Holmes of debugging.
Exactly.
Yeah, I do love that like investigation aspect. And since we're talking about it, I'd like to try to pick at your brain a little bit and maybe get some tips for me and our listeners. Like, what is your process when you get, which is something that happens to me quite often, like you get a bug report and you can definitely tell that there's something wrong, because another thing that I find is that often bug reports are not actually bug reports, but it's actually someone who didn't understand how something works, and that's not their fault. It's probably a usability issue with the app, which is probably a bug at the end of the day, but you can tell that like this is actually a real bug, something that shouldn't be happening, but there's just so little to go by from what I got here. How do you go about trying to expand your context about the bug in order to investigate it better?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So it depends a little bit about, like, first of all, what kind of bug report are we talking about? For example, if we're talking about a crash, then looking at, again, more than just like that single stack trace or that single snapshot, but trying to gather more information, get a bigger picture, get a more complete view of the situation can really, really help in just like trying to get some hint as to what might be the problem and how can you fix it, especially if you get something like a bad access crash, right?
Right.
Or like an auto layout crash or something like that. Like, those can very often be like debugging equivalent of a red herring in a story, right?
Right?
Where it's actually the thing you're looking at is not the actual problem, but the problem is somewhere else, right?
Right.
So that can be tricky. So often getting a more kind of complete view of the situation there is good. And the same thing I would say applies when you're talking about something that is user reported. So if a user reaches out and says like, hey, I found this problem, or I can't do this, or when I do this, this happens, and that's kind of unexpected. Very often, I've actually started reaching back out to customers and users and actually getting more information from them, whether that's like a screen recording or if there's some logs you can get from the device or something like that, or just like more information about the thing they're trying to do. If there's any input data, like for example, if you're working on like a photo app or something, like if you can get the photos that they're trying to process, of course, sometimes users might not agree to share that data and that's fine. But, you know, very often I found that if a user reports a bug to you, that's already a kind of high level of engagement with the app, right?
Right.
Like sometimes that's seen as a negative, like, oh, this user is reporting a bug, how annoying. But it's not. It's actually a super positive thing. Like if your user cares enough about your app or your product that they reach out when something goes wrong, that's a good user. Like that's someone that I think is good to reach back out to. And very often I found that people are very, very happy to help out and to provide more information and help kind of with the investigation.
Right.
And so that's one thing. And if that's not possible, or if that's not like, you know, you don't get that feedback, the same thing applies as to the crash reports, I would say, where getting more aggregate information, not just looking at one report, but trying to find similar reports from other users or like beta testers or whatever it might be, that can give you more information about this issue. So you can kind of build a more complete picture before like jumping to the conclusions, right? Before deciding right. that this component or this part of the code is what's wrong. It's much better, I feel like, to gather those clues first and then start actually looking at a fix. Because I found then you can kind of look at it with a more clear view and you can remove a lot of the frustration involved in just kind of, you know, poking at different things to see what happens. You instead have a more kind of organized approach to fixing the bug.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's definitely an approach that I take with my apps. And I'm lucky that I'm an indie developer, so it's really easy to just reach back out to the person who's reporting the bug. And I also do agree with the people who report stuff are your best users because they care. If they didn't care about your app, they wouldn't be reporting. They would just stop using your app. So if they're taking their time to report a bug, especially if it's like a more detailed report, then they care about your app and they really want it to be better. And you should definitely be thankful for that. And it always reminds me these interactions about like back in like House MD when he's interviewing a patient in the clinic and they talk about a lot of stuff that they're having and things like that and they can't figure out what's going on, but then the person is like about to leave the office like with their hand on the door handle and then they say, oh, and by the way, I also have this cough.
And right.
That often happens with these like bug reports where the initial report will be straightforward, like, oh, I did this and this weird thing happened or it crashed or whatever. But then you'll have like a sometimes fairly long exchange, like trying to figure out what's going on. And then in the middle of the conversation, there will be this little snippet of information like, oh, and by the way, I use my system in Russian with US region settings or something, like a weird combination you didn't quite expect. And that could give you a clue. And something that I also like to do sometimes is cross-reference between different reports, because often reports will come in different shapes and forms, but when you look at the variables involved, you'll find out that, oh, this is actually just one bug that all of these people are reporting. So if I just figure out what's the same between these people's environment and devices and OS versions and things like that, and what's different, then I can probably figure out what combination of settings and things like that causes the bug.
Yeah, absolutely. I think those are really, really good points as well. And then like the second kind of big learning for me or thing I've been really trying to improve is kind of really never saying like it works on my machine, right? like because of course a lot of the bugs will work on your machine, because if it didn't, then you would have fixed it already, right?
Right.
So very often, like, it comes down to what we might call an edge case, or it might be just like you said, like different configurations that is triggering the issue, or like specific data, like I talked about before, that's triggering the issue. But the issue is still happening. So like denying it is not going to do anyone any good, right?
Right.
So it's more about like trying so many different things, like whether it's like getting better reports from users, or just like going into the code and like starting to like comment out code and see if you can like reproduce it somehow, like isolate it to some specific part of the code base, or, you know, trying to like extract code into a separate project and try to reproduce it there, like trying all these different things, which like is a lot of work usually, and it's not easy, and there's no like one thing you can just do to fix any bug. Like it's a lot of guesswork, and it's a lot of just like trying out many different things. But I think the key is just to like, in your mind, like in like, again, comes down so much to like attitude and how you approach something. Like what I'd really try to do is to like just like constantly remember that this is an issue, that it exists, someone has it, like multiple people have it, maybe I just need to find what it is. It's not that it works on my machine and they are just holding it wrong, like you said before. it is an issue and it needs to be fixed, and approaching something with that mindset. And similarly, also not immediately jumping to, oh, this must be like a Swift UI bug, or this must be like an Apple bug, but actually like having the attitude that this is a bug in my code somewhere here, I just need to find it. Like, it might sound simple, but that change in attitude and mindset really makes a huge difference for me, because that means I'm just more open-minded to trying new things. And, you know, if all else fails, I might just add a whole bunch of logging to the code and then like ship a beta to TestFlight or something, just to kind of get more data and more information so I can see what is actually going on here. But really like not giving up and saying, oh, it works on my machine, or this is probably someone just holding it wrong, but actually treating it as, this is a real issue that is occurring, I just need to figure it out. Like that is, it's been a really big shift for me as well, and really helped me to get much better at debugging and solving these issues. And then like the final thing for me has just been really, like I mentioned, focusing on this so much and actually really getting much, much better, because I just like exercise those muscles, right? Like I just, I've spent so much time this year and the past year on just these kinds of issues, and it just made me better overall at this process. And I think that's just the final thing of like just doing something over and over and over and over again, and being kind of analytical about it and approaching it in an organized manner does usually improve things over time.
Right. I do have one more question. So you work a lot with clients, so you, every now and then you are facing a code base that you are not familiar with and might have varying levels of quality. And of course, without disclosing anything about your clients, but have you found at some point where you were brought onto a project and there was an existing code base and it was such a rat's nest and you had a lot of bugs to fix, but you thought that you would just be like playing whack-a-mole with the bugs, where it's one of those code bases where if you fix a thing here, something breaks over there. Have you had to approach that sort of problem before, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, definitely. I've definitely had that situation many, many times. And I think the thing there is just like, you're not actually playing whack-a-mole. It might feel like it, but if you fix bugs and you continue to improve the code base, it will get better over time. So it's again comes down to kind of just the attitude, right? And not giving up and not feeling like what you're doing is pointless, because this code base will never be fixed. It's just, let's just throw it away and rewrite it, because we've talked about this many times in the past. Like, I'm definitely more of a refactor and improve over time person rather than a rewrite person.
Right.
Like sometimes I will rewrite individual subsystems that might be problematic or just outdated, or like as part of a technology migration, like you're moving to a new version of a new API that might warrant some kind of rewrite or restructuring of the code. But when it comes to the projects themselves, I like to just like keep iterating. And I've definitely worked on many problematic code bases where over time I've been able to improve things drastically, like either by myself or with other people working together as a team. And it's definitely possible. And sometimes it is a little bit like whack-a-mole. You do fix one thing and then another thing starts happening because that code relied on a broken behavior that you fixed, right?
Right.
But then it's just a matter of going and fixing that and then fixing the next one and the next one. And then if you just do that enough times, like I've found that you can definitely improve things a lot. And you can also like in the meantime, do some targeted refactorings here and there to kind of improve things and improve the testability, for example, and add more structure to the code to make it easier to work with. But even like the worst possible spaghetti code rat's nest, whatever you want to call it, is fixable by kind of pulling those threads and kind of continuously fix things. It might take a longer time, like over time, compared to if you would just like throw everything out and rewrite it. But I think it's still like a more efficient use of resources for the vast majority of projects, because you do end up, I think, even if it takes like time goes by, like it's a longer period of time, but the actual time you spend on the project and the amount of value you can deliver to users, I feel like, is much higher when you do the refactoring route, because you can continuously ship the app. You don't have to stop it all and rewrite it from the beginning and then cause a whole bunch of other issues, right? So I do feel like it's just about like trying to like get a good view of the project and go through the backlog, go through the reported issues, look at what's there, and just try to like organize it around priority and just start working. And then it can actually be quicker than you at the beginning might expect to bring the quality of the code base up significantly.
Yeah, at some point you gotta run out of moles to whack, right?
Exactly. Yeah. At some point, the moles move somewhere else.
Right.
So what about you, Rambo? So that was a long kind of discussion about what I've been doing around like trying to get better at debugging and feeling like I've partially succeeded, at least. I'm definitely not going to say like I'm a debugging perfect person. I can just fix any bug you will throw at me. But I feel like I've gotten a lot better. And after all, that's all we can ever do, right? Continuously get better.
Right.
No one is perfect, but we can try to get better. So what about you? How have you been trying to get better this year, Rambo?
Well, I've improved on a lot of things this year, including a newfound appreciation for automated testing, which we definitely talked about a little bit in previous episodes. Been using SwiftUI for almost all the things, with a lot of UIKit and AppKit sprinkled on top or below it, depending on how you look at it. But I think the big theme this year, John, and keeping with the hype, is AI.
All right. And, you know, a lot of people are talking about AI, and some of it is super interesting and super, like, groundbreaking. Some of it is perhaps not as interesting and not going to lead anywhere to some actual concrete, like, improvements in terms of products.
Right.
But when I look at what you're doing, Rambo, and specifically, I think, you know, you are applying AI in some incredibly interesting ways, and you are finding really, really interesting use cases, I feel like, for integrating these technologies into your existing projects, which is, you know, double as interesting, I would say. So can you just like do a recap for our listeners and talk more about how you have been integrating AI so far?
It's funny because I have been using AI and generative AI more specifically for pretty much the entirety of this year. And I've been developing projects that integrate AI, but I haven't shipped any, not even on beta. So people do not know what we're talking about right now.
It just makes it more interesting, right? It's more mystery.
Right. But it's interesting because when you're doing this sort of thing, it's interesting how it all kind of becomes a circle, because I am currently working on some AI things for Chibi Studio, which so far from all of the prototypes and experiments I've been doing is the one I'm most excited about. And what's interesting is how it will be a part of both what's deployed and made available to users, but also how in working on this project, I'm using AI to help me with the project itself. So it's very interesting. And I think what helps me take better advantage of these tools is to think of them as tools. And I think there's definitely a discussion to be had, not on this podcast, about like all of the social and political and like financial implications of adopting AI and stuff like that. But I think the more you view these AI tools as what they are, which in my opinion, they're just tools, and you think about like ChatGPT or DALL-E or Stable Diffusion and things like that, as like Photoshop or Xcode. They are just tools to help you with whatever it is that you have to do. The more you are able to take real advantage of them, because of course it's fun to play around and like create jokes and fictional texts and things like that. And you could definitely use it to help you with writing and other stuff. But it's even better if you can adopt them as tools to do what you're already doing. So one thing in like the tool aspect that I really like about things like ChatGPT, especially now with GPT-4 and it can like search Bing and do other stuff for you, is it's a very effective rubber duck. So sometimes I am stuck with a problem or running out of ideas for something, and I'll just start like chatting with the model. And it's not that it's going to necessarily give me the solution for something, but sometimes just by expressing what I'm thinking to the model, and maybe I could do the same just by writing stuff down in notes or something, but I think having this back and forth, even though I know there is no person on the other side, but it's this thing that's collecting a bunch of knowledge and trying to create messages that are that sound meaningful, just by doing that process, I will get unstuck sometimes.
Yeah, and I feel like there is two kind of vectors to that here, where, like you mentioned, you could have probably gotten a lot of value also just by writing it down, or, you know, the rubber duck thing comes from like people actually talking to an object, right? Like talking to a rubber duck, for example,
right,
explaining a code problem and therefore arriving at a solution, because by just expressing it or context switching and doing something else, like looking at the problem in a different way, you can sometimes just arrive at a solution or think of new ideas, right?
Right.
So I think that's definitely one thing. And then the second thing is, well, the difference between a rubber duck and something like ChatGPT or an AI system or machine learning model is that they can actually give you some answers, right? They are actually giving you some feedback back. So I feel like I that's something I want to try more as well. Perhaps that's going to go on my list for self-improvement for next year for me, is to also try to integrate AI tools more into my workflows as well.
Right. On a more practical example, we've recently completely redid the ASO for Chibi Studio, so the App Store search optimization. We used to be number one in the US App Store if you searched for Chibi. So just the word Chibi, it would be the first one in search results, after the ads, of course. But that changed a while back, and we saw a significant decrease in both impressions, downloads, and by consequence, sales in Chibi Studio. And we kind of just left it there and just kept going with it. But I decided to actually try to do something about it. So I started doing some research about App Store optimization. There are great resources by App Figures and other tools like that you can use in order to learn more about how it works. Some little tips and tricks on how to get the most out of your App Store keywords and descriptions and things like that. So I took a bunch of that knowledge and also took a bunch of the articles I read from several different sources about App Store optimization, and I created a custom GPT assistant, which I call ASO Assistant, which is a thing you can do now with GPT, ChatGPT, and started going through like the situation with Chibi Studio, sharing some metrics and some information about the app itself, screenshots of the app even, because it can also like understand images now. And I chatted with this assistant for a while and used it in order to generate both new suggestions for titles and subtitles, descriptions, keywords, and all of that stuff. And we applied some of those changes, of course, after editing and reviewing. And also, we didn't just accept all of the suggestions. Some of them were not very good. But going through this process, I was able to figure out like a new metadata package, basically, for the app in the App Store. And since applying those changes, we've seen over 100% increase in impressions and downloads in the App Store.
Wow.
And we're now back at number one for the word chibi in search in the US. So it definitely helped. I could have done that without ChatGPT, but it just made the process more iterative, I think, and more fun even, because it came up with some wild suggestions that I was like, nope, there's no way I'm taking this. And if you read the description for the app in the App Store, I'm not proud of that description. Like, I don't like it. There's just too much keywords in the description. It's like English. It makes sense. If someone wants to read it, they will learn a lot about the app by reading it. But it's not how I would write it. But the truth is, when you're writing an App Store description, you're writing for the algorithm, not for people. Because let's be honest, most people don't read the description anyway. They just look at the screenshots and download the app. So yeah, that's like a practical use case that really helped us quite a bit with improving the visibility of the app.
That's super cool. And like I mentioned before here, I'm very intrigued by the way you've been deploying AI, both what you've showed me, what you're doing in some of your projects that haven't been released yet, but also things that you just talked about here. Like, it's very, very interesting to me, like this way of approaching it. And it feels like you're very good at coming up with ways to apply it that are not just, you know, oh, I'm going to use Copilot to generate this function in code or something like that. Like, you're using it for like workflow things. And one other thing that I've noticed from some of the prompts and different instructions you've shared with me, like that you've given to these models, is that I feel like you've gotten kind of good at that, like formulating these prompts and these instructions in very detailed ways that I would probably not have thought of myself, like currently, because I don't have that much experience with it yet. Like when you've showed me how you've been able to create certain characters and so on, like to make ChatGPT take on this persona, if you will, like it's been really cool to see these results. So can you talk a little bit more maybe about your process of learning that? Like, because I feel like a lot of people are maybe in my position where I've tried ChatGPT many, many times and, you know, trying to find ways to integrate it into my workflows, but haven't gotten to the point yet where I feel like you are, where you feel like it feels, at least from my perspective, from the outside, that you've spent a lot of time like learning how to kind of optimize these tools for yourself.
Right. I think it's probably easier for developers because we are used to having to tell the computer to do everything, right? Usually when you write code, if you don't write a piece of code, that functionality won't exist. And you have to be aware of that with these tools as well. But most importantly, you have to be aware that if something is missing from your prompt, it's going to infer what you meant or what's missing. And I feel like, especially if you're talking about generative AI for images, it's very important to be very specific about the things you want it to generate in the image exactly as you're saying, and where it has, and it feels weird to say it like this, but where it will have creative freedom over what it's doing. So it doesn't have creativity. It's just a model, I know, but you know what I mean. So you have to be very specific about all of the details, because you have to remember that this tool does not have all the context that you have when in your brain about what you are trying to achieve. So you have to give it as much context as possible about what you're trying to achieve in order to get a better result and a result that more resembles what you are trying to achieve. And I think I'm pretty sure I've seen job postings for the role of prompt engineer, actually.
Yeah, definitely starting to happen, I feel like.
Yeah, it's basically a new field. And this is the sort of thing that gives me hope that there will still be jobs for most people, because it's not magic. You do have to be thoughtful about how you do the prompting. And specifically about applying these tools as like features in apps and whatnot, I feel like a lot of people are taking what I consider to be the lazy route, which is to just have a chat in your app, and that's it. Like, yes, ChatGPT, it's in the name. It's a chat, like you talk to it as a chat. But what's behind it, the model, which is GPT-4, and there are other models, there's GPT-4 Vision, which can describe images and things like that. What's behind it is just a generative model. And I like to think of ways of integrating these features in apps and services and whatever, but not in a direct way where people are going to be chatting with these tools, but in a way where I use them as a backend for a feature, but the prompting happens in the background and is completely transparent to the user, whether it's using a ChatGPT API or whatever. So I think now that the gold rush is basically over, I think there's probably like more than a million ChatGPT chat apps in the App Store. I think it's time for us to start integrating these tools as tools to achieve something where the prompt engineering happens in the background and we are doing the prompt engineering and just providing a feature for users. And that's what I've been working on for something in Chibi Studio, which you have seen. And I'm honestly still impressed myself, like not at what I've been able to do, but at what these models can do with a little bit of work. And yeah, how I've been able to create a feature where people are using these tools, but they don't have to know about it. They don't have to know how to create a good prompt and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like with the features that you've been showing, I feel like you've been incrementally getting better at kind of hiding those implementation details, right? And providing a easier, simpler user experience that, to your point, if you're not in the know and you know of these generative AI techniques and how they actually work, it's possible to use these features and just like feel like it's some kind of magic under the hood, right? Like it's not exposing those implementation details of ChatGPT to the end user, which I think is a good design approach, at least for many different products. And just also, again, looking at what you've been doing here for quite a while now with all these experiments, it's also clear that to your point, what you said yourself earlier, you haven't shipped anything yet to end users. So it's pretty clear that you've been maybe discarding some experiments that you feel like this was not good enough to ship, or you kind of moved in a different direction. So what's your kind of thought process there? Like, how would you decide that this particular experiment that I'm working on right now is good enough to ship? Like, what are the criteria you're looking at in order to actually deploy it in production?
Well, definitely safety is a big one, right? There is a big deal with these types of tools, which is basically a new type of security vulnerability, which is prompt injection. So just as you have SQL injection, you also can have prompt injection. So if at any point you're taking in user-generated content and feeding it through one of these models, you have to be aware of the possibility that there's going to be prompt injection. And that's not the only possible issue, but that is one of them. Also, specifically with the one I've been showing you in Chibi Studio, which I think it's fairly obvious that it has to do with image generation, right? So I'm not going to really reveal everything about the feature here, but it has to do with image generation. We had a hard time figuring out, but I have figured it out, how to get the model to respect things related to diversity. And I'm talking about human diversity. Like, if the character has a different skin color than the default, like, beige skin color of chibis, like, if it has a darker skin color, or even, like, a blue skin color, we had to work a little bit with the prompt engineering to make it absolutely sure that the model is going to follow what's being told to it, because depending on what you ask it to generate and the theme and the context, it might skew towards a specific skin tone, which might not be the one that the person wants to generate. So those kinds of even like social issues are things that we are really thinking about before we ship anything. And it always bothers me because we are doing all this hard work and thinking about these complicated issues and finding out solutions before we ship anything. And you see sometimes like big companies with whole teams that just ship stuff that has like terrible issues in this regard, and no one seems to care, but we do. So yeah, we are taking precautions with things like safety and diversity and other things like that. And there's, besides that, there's also like technical and also financial things that we have to figure out. Like, we will need some sort of either subscription model or credit-based model in order to provide this, because we have API costs and we can't just like sell one in-app purchase and then the person gets to use it forever. That's not going to be sustainable. And also, some of the features we're using from OpenAI are still in beta and they are not ready for production traffic. So we'll probably have to ship them as like a test flight first, and I'll definitely let people know in my socials when that happens. So yeah, there's like safety and technical and financial / business things that we have to figure out before we ship anything.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think it's really amazing that you're spending so much effort on these issues and making sure the products end up being as safe as possible, as, you know, respectful of the user's intent and what they actually want to generate, and being, you know, respect diversity and so on. Like, I think that's absolutely fantastic. Of course, like with technologies like these that are new and also so open, right? Like, right, that's the whole thing. Like, you can generate things out of thin air from what it seems like, right? From the user's perspective, it's hard to have complete control. It's, I would say, almost impossible to have complete control, right? Because you are not in control. You're not actually writing the code tailor-made to generate this specific image or generate this specific content. It's all kind of happening inside of the model at the end of the day, but you can do as much as you possibly can to shield your users from any potential harm or just things not working properly, right? Like, I think that's a great approach to take. And, you know, eventually you'll probably have to like decide that this is good enough to ship, right? But I think it's really good that you're taking your time, because if you launch a product like this, like, or a feature that has a lot more polish into it and it feels like easier to use, and it's less of a, you know, minefield where you might run into things that you didn't want to see and so on, I think that's just, you know, it's going to be a better user experience at the end of the day, right?
Yeah. And also on the technical side, one big thing, which considering what you can do with these tools, it's not a big deal. But considering how comfortable people are with technology and with how fast technology is these days, it does take quite a while. Like, for some of the workflows we're doing that we plan on shipping, it can take like 20 seconds for something to be done, which is super fast, like considering what's happening. But so that means that, let's say we have a feature where you can do something in the app, we can't just have people wait 20 seconds staring at a loading screen. So I'm also working on solutions for that, with things like using live activities, like, you don't use Instagram, but Instagram recently they shipped an update where if you post a story and it is taking a while to upload, it will become a live activity so that you can keep track of the progress. And you'll see, like, in the dynamic island, if your iPhone has a dynamic island, it will like show a little check mark or something when it's done uploading. So we're thinking about doing stuff like that. And I guess given that it has a live activity, it also gives it a better ability to upload faster or something. So yeah, we're looking into things like that, having like some cute, fun, mesmerizing animations while things are happening. So if you do want to stare at the screen while it does its thing, it's not that boring. So there's also like that technical and like usability aspect to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've talked a lot about loading states here on this podcast, but not 20-second loading states, at least not like at the default, right? Like, sometimes, of course, a network call can take 20 seconds, but that's not what we would expect under most kind of normal network conditions, right?
Right.
So yeah, definitely a whole new degree of loading states, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's like all of your users have enabled network link conditioner and forgot to disable it.
Exactly. And they're on like the edge network and not on 4G or 5G.
Right.
So switching gears here a little bit, one more thing that I wanted to mention here, like regarding how I've changed kind of my approach to development and so on this year, is a more kind of technical aspect. And just like you, I've been continuously adopting SwiftUI and working more and more with SwiftUI. And I think that's, you know, true for both of our projects and for many other people listening to the show as well who are iOS developers or working on Apple's platforms. And one thing that I've been doing for since I started with SwiftUI more or less, so for quite a long time, is I've been using the view model pattern quite a lot. Right. And I feel like this become very, very popular in SwiftUI in general too. You have a view model, it's an observable object or just at observable, and you then observe it in your view. You have published properties or you're using the new API and so on. And you feed that view with data through the view model, and then you put like the logic inside of the view model, whether those are like network calls or database calls or whatever it might be. And that's kind of your regular setup. And there is a lot of things about that setup that is very, very appealing and works really well. Like you can very easily move logic out of your view that way and have the view just be responsible for the rendering. It just has that reference to the view model. And then, you know, all the logic happens in the view model, which means that you can more easily test it under most conditions. And you have that nice separation of concern, right? Which right. we are often looking for as developers and in terms of architecture. But over time, I've started to feel like in many cases, the view model pattern in SwiftUI is either a little bit too heavy, especially if I'm just building like a simpler component. I feel like, does this component really need like a view model? Can't it just take some data as normal vars, like normal just input parameters, and just have a body where you just render that data and that's it, right?
Right.
Like, do you really need a view model for this? And also, like, even if you scale that up a little bit, if you have a couple of actions and so on, couldn't you just implement that as just like a closure or a binding or something like that? Like, again, is that view model abstraction really needed? And then the second thing is there are many situations where the ownership of such a view model can become quite tricky to implement in a predictable way. Right. So for example, if you have like a list of things, let's say you're building like a movie app and you have a list of movies, and then you tap one of the movies, you go to the movie detail view. That movie detail view, if it needs a view model, then where do you create it and how do you store it?
Right.
Do you create it in the list view and then pass it in as an observed object or, you know, just as a var now with the new observation API? Or do you do like a state object or at state or something like that to keep a reference, like predictable reference inside of the child view, the detail view? But then the problem is if the parent view data changes, then the child view won't be automatically updated. So you will need to do some manual work there. But if you take the first approach, then every time the parent view is updated, the body is reevaluated, the view model can very often end up being recreated, right?
Right.
Which is definitely not what you want in most cases, at least, because it can lead to state loss. And then you end up with these kind of situations where you need to like maybe keep a cache of your view models manually, or you need to do some manual state observation, or extract things out into a separate object that holds the state or something like that. Or maybe you implement a more lightweight view model that can be recreated, and that's fine. Like, I feel like very often we end up with these kind of workarounds. And I've personally found that in many projects, going kind of too far with this kind of architecture, if you want to call it like that, or the view model pattern, can end up feeling like you're fighting the framework a bit. I don't know, Rambo, have you also had this feeling?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And especially around the thing where do I create my view model or controller or whatever you call it? And also something I've noticed as I was debugging some stuff in VirtualBuddy a while back is how easy it can be to create retain cycles in SwiftUI. This is something I'm quite aware of now when I'm developing, because I've had some nasty surprises in some of my projects where I expected something to have a given life cycle, but it didn't, and that ended up causing retain cycle issues and other sorts of bugs. And I guess it's more common if you are integrating more custom things like AppKit and UIKit, but I definitely saw some places where, wait, I'm just using SwiftUI here, and where is this retain cycle? Oh, there's a closure somewhere, and it accesses like the view model state object, and that's being retained. Oh, that's where it comes from. So, yeah,
exactly.
I've definitely been more leaning towards For example, like a very common place where I would usually employ a view model would be something like a form. Like I have a form to edit something, and I would have a view model that deals with state and like validation, and maybe there needs to be some sort of translation between the underlying model and what the form controls expect. These days, I've been doing that either on the model itself, because you can have mutating functions in Swift structs, so that works, and also validation, like you can have a function that throws if there is a validation error, and that can be in the struct itself. And I usually implement those as an extension. Like I'll have the main struct and I'll have an extension with all of the, like the editing functions and things like that. But if it's too complicated to use the same model and it would cause problems with other aspects of the model, I'll just have like another model type that does all of that work. Because usually that stuff doesn't really require any extra state that's not a part of the view. Like, am I showing an error in this field or something? You can have that be a part of your model itself, but it's usually fine to have that as just a part of the view, because I don't feel like I need to have unit tests for at state is alert visible or something. I think
right.
That's not necessary. So yeah, I'm definitely also falling out of love with view models.
Right. And, you know, I just want to also mention here before we continue that I still like the pattern of view models. So this is not to say that view models are bad and I
right.
don't use them anymore. In my projects right now, I have migrated a lot of code away from view models, or new code doesn't use them anymore. But there's still a lot of cases where I am using a view model and I'm super happy with it. And it's like a really good fit for those things. For example, if you have a view where you have a lot of different logic going on that is specific to that view, so it's not really something that you would want maybe to extract to some other service or controller or something, but you want it to be tied to that specific view, but you don't want to implement it in the view struct itself, then a view model is a really good fit, because you can just like move that logic out, have that in the view model. The view model can probably be like privately created as a state object if it doesn't have any dependencies. That's even better. And then, you know, you can just use it there inside of the view, and you can unit test it if you want to, and it works really, really well. So it's not to say that the pattern is bad or anything. It's just like with all things, like it's good to, I think, find where are the edges, like where is this thing really, really good? And where are the edges where it starts becoming more problems than it's worth, right? Like where another metaphor is maybe a better option. And I think that's what app architecture all comes down to at the end, is just like finding out what are the tools we want to use in this project? Like, what does our toolbox look like? And what is the range of each tool? Like what kind of use cases does this tool cover and this tool cover, and so on? And another kind of reason why I started like having these thoughts about view models also is because I've been embracing the Swift UI environment a lot, like over the last few years, where I really love the Swift UI environment. I think it's really, really powerful, and you can very easily just like pass values and things and even actions with closures down through a view hierarchy. So you can have something like an error reporter that you just add in the environment. And then whenever there's an error occurring in some view, you can just do like add environment error reporter. You can just say report error. And then the error reporter can decide like, do I show an alert here or do I report it? Like, you know, do I log something to the backend or something? Do I retry the operation? And like, you can create some really powerful mechanisms that lets you kind of build up this, well, environment of kind of functionality that you can use throughout your application without having to specifically pass dependencies around all the time, which I think is, you know, really, really great and really powerful. And that pattern doesn't always play super well with view models either, because then you have that view model that you have as a state object, for example, or just as a private state property in your view, but then you have to kind of connect the environment values to that view model by like doing it on a peer or something like that. And then you end up with this kind of, you know, you have a lot of optionals and different state that you have to manage. And there are, of course, ways to work around that. But again, it feels like getting into more problems than you're actually getting benefits from this pattern in those cases. So yeah, it's another kind of thing to consider. And I absolutely agree with what you said earlier there, that some logic can definitely be implemented directly on model types, especially if it's like you said, a mutating function that just updates the model. Or in the case of validation, like you mentioned earlier, you can just create a validator type, right? It doesn't have to be necessarily a view model. And here is what I've been starting to really move towards in a kind of very concrete way, is that I want to try now these days to minimize the amount of view-specific state that I keep.
Right.
So I've been migrating a lot to services where the service doesn't actually have a reference to the specific model that the specific view is using. That I instead keep inside of the view itself. So the view, for example, might have a model that it keeps keep a reference to, and that can just be injected with at binding. It's just a value type, or just have a private at state property. And then it can talk to a service, but the service will not like keep a reference to the model and keep the state around. It will just perform some action on the model, whether it's like update the database or make a network call or whatever it might be, and then return a new model or return nothing at all or throw an error if it happened. And then the view can just like talk to that service, and the service, like, you don't end up with that ownership problem anymore that you can face with view models, because the service can be retained somewhere else, like where you set up your whole kind of, you know, application stack, basically. And the everything becomes a lot more stateless and more just input output. And I feel like that pattern works better, at least in most cases, in Swift UI, where you don't have that view specific state that has to be passed around with kind of ambiguous ownership and risk of retain cycles, like you mentioned, or just like view models going out of memory, or you have something like a state object where you're not actually in control of the memory lifecycle because the system keeps track of that object for you, which is good in some ways, but it also can lead to ambiguous results if you are using something like deallocate to actually perform like some cleanup actions and so on.
Right.
So yeah, I found that having view state be in the views themselves and then talk to different kinds of services or different classes or objects or functions that implement the actual functionality that can then be unit tested and managed separately, that strikes a really nice balance, for me at least, for the majority of use cases.
As we know, mutable state is the root of all evil.
Yeah, exactly. That's where the bugs come in.
Exactly.
But I think like it's not just this segment, I feel like, about specifically view models or services or what have you, but I feel like one thing that I always try to do, and as much as I possibly can, is to, when I'm writing my code, to make it feel like it's designed in a way that's compatible with whatever framework or technology I'm using at the moment.
Right.
So when I'm using Swift UI, I want to feel like my code is not fighting the system. I don't have to do all these workarounds. I don't have to do all these on appear and manual bindings and manage my state manually, because I shouldn't have to do that in Swift UI. Swift UI should just take care of it. And similar with things like the environment, I want to make my code very compatible with the Swift UI environment because it's so powerful and it's such a big part of Swift UI. And similarly, when I'm working with UIKit, I also want to write code that is very UIKit compatible, and that involves usually different patterns than with Swift UI. So I think like when I find myself in a situation where I feel like I'm constantly fighting the system, or I'm doing something that feels like it's not like, you know, compatible with the way this framework was designed, I try to find a different approach or tweak my approach, even if I might be the biggest fan of view models personally. I might think it's a great metaphor or a great kind of way to structure code. But at the end of the day, the quality of the code and the maintenance aspect of the code, what will really, really have a big impact there is how compatible it is with the libraries I'm using. Even if I may or may not fully agree with it, I want to make sure it's fully compatible.
Yeah, that makes sense. And definitely like the biggest warning that something could be improved significantly in your architecture is when you feel like you're fighting the framework. And I feel like we've mentioned that several times on this show. So whenever I feel like I'm fighting the framework, I stop and think something must be changed here.
Yeah, exactly. So Rambo, any final things? Any other things you've been focusing on this year, or learning, or improving this year overall?
Yeah, I feel like we've done a good job at summarizing everything. The other main points is that I have been using SwiftUI a lot more. And I think my realization, which apparently you also came to a similar realization, is that the view model approach might not be the best one for most situations in SwiftUI. And I definitely do agree with what you mentioned, that it's not that view models are dead or that you should never use them, but definitely reduced a lot of my usage of them in SwiftUI over the past year. And yeah, been automating more things. And That also has to do with SwiftUI, because as I also think we've talked about before, when you make things more testable, it also helps with things such as SwiftUI previews, which I am like completely dependent on these days. Like if I can't use SwiftUI previews, I feel like I'm in the past and I'm developing like on the Stone Age or something, because it really speeds up iteration. And I'm not even sure we should call them SwiftUI previews anymore, because you can do them for UIKit and AppKit. And I've definitely been using SwiftUI previews for both my AppKit stuff and UIKit stuff whenever I do those things these days. So yeah, and highly recommend working towards a more testable code base with things like adopting more protocols and things like that, so that you can have better SwiftUI previews that hopefully don't touch the real data.
Yeah, exactly. And it comes back to that same thing we just talked about, like trying to design our code in a way that's compatible with the overall system, even if it might feel unfair that we have to do that. Because yeah, one thing I've noticed as I've been working on many, many different projects throughout this year and previous years as a freelancer is, you know, some projects work really good, really well with SwiftUI previews. It might be because of their size or just like the kind of way they're set up, their dependencies. There are many different factors here. But I found that some projects work really, really well with it, and some projects work terribly with it, where, you know, the previews are super slow to update, or they are super unreliable. They throw these strange errors all the time, and so on and so forth. And, you know, you can look at that and say, that's Apple's problem. It kind of is. But at the same time, it's also, if you want to use previews, it's kind of also our problem, right? Or, you know, the Apple are hopefully going to improve and continue to improve this preview system. But, you know, they're not likely going to just like immediately prioritize fixing it for your specific project, right?
Yeah.
So if you want to adopt SwiftUI previews, I think this starting to like refactor the project in a way that makes them more SwiftUI compatible can also be a good approach if that's kind of the workflow that you want to achieve. And, you know, one concrete example is that if you're able to extract certain key components into something like a separate library or something like that, that can have like a separate integration demo app or something, you can use previews there, or there's even the possibility of using previews in Swift packages now and so on. That can be really beneficial, because like if you have a really huge project with a lot of code and a lot of dependencies and so on, it can be really tricky to get that to work reliably with SwiftUI previews, and it will probably be the case for a while going forward. But if you can restructure the project in a little bit, or maybe extract some UI code, or even when you're working with it, you might just like take part of your code base and just like move it to a separate project temporarily if you're building a new component or something, and then use previews there and integrate it back in when you're done. So there are different approaches you can take here, but I do agree. I've been also optimizing for previews, even though I use previews a lot and I really, really like previews, but I've actually stopped checking in my preview code into my code repositories. And the reason for that is I just found it to become a bit of a maintenance burden, where I have to, like, when I'm updating certain APIs and so on, I have to go through and also update the previews. And also because often I want the previews to be easy to just like create, because that also means that I've designed my views in a way that it's easy to use. So I can very quickly, when I'm working on something, just create a preview from scratch and just set up that view in the state that I want it right now, and not have to worry about like maintaining that preview code. I can just set it up, work on it, and then not check it in when I'm actually committing to my repository.
Yes, some of my previews, especially in Airbody, are quite complex. So I keep those. And by the way, that is something, of course, if you can have a preview where it's just like a pound preview, open, close, and your view inside, that's perfect. But if you have a more complicated need and you want like a prototype maybe where you can tweak parameters and things like that, and you are completely allowed to create a separate SwiftUI view that you can use just for previewing stuff. I actually have for the status window, which is now called the Action HUD in Airbody, a whole like preview system, because there are so many different variations of what the HUD can show. Like it can show volume, brightness, AirPods status and also like now playing stuff in version 3. So there's a lot of variations and even like sequences of events that can happen. So I have a protocol where I have defined all of the possible states that I want to preview. And I also have 3 different looks for the Action HUD, because it can be a large window, a small window, or it can be integrated into the notch on some Macs. So I have separate previews for each of the design variations of where it can be shown, so the different contexts, but I have a single implementation for what are these previews going to be showing, so that I can quickly do a tweak and see its effect on all possible variations and states. And I would definitely not be able to ship this feature if it wasn't for SwiftUI previews. Or I would have to create a more complicated system myself to be able to preview things quickly, because there are so many possible variations and little details that doing like a little metric tweak, if I had to like build and run and then test each one after the other, it would just take forever.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And, you know, that's the power of great developer tools, right? They enable you to do new things that wouldn't be practically possible before. Because, of course, you could have written the same UI code without previews, but perhaps you wouldn't have been able to do it in a timely manner, right? Because you're a single person working on all these projects, so you have to also prioritize your time. And I think the same thing can be said for SwiftUI overall, is that when it works really well and when you can be really productive using it, it enables like new ways of working, right? Like there are certain projects I work on where I'm the only developer maintaining an app with very few hours per month, because that specific project perhaps is in more like a maintenance mode. And because it's written with SwiftUI, or it's written in a way that is kind of easy to maintain for me, I can do that without requiring a lot of my time, and, you know, therefore being very cost efficient for the clients as well. So yeah, great developer tools, I think, open up so many new opportunities for developers. So always very exciting. Yeah.
As for tips on getting the best out of them, highly recommend having a separate module for previewing. So in my case, I usually have some sort of UI framework for my app where all of the UI components are, and I usually do the previews with that framework target selected. So that makes previewing a lot faster. And also, just in case, I always enclose everything that has to do with previews in pound if debug, pound end if, so that it absolutely has no chance of ever getting compiled for release builds. Because I've seen problems sometimes where like you have some debug code that is only in debug builds and it's used in the preview, and the previews are supposed to be stripped out of release builds, but during the archive, the build fails because it's accessing something that's only available in debug. So I suggest doing that.
Yeah, I do the same thing. And even though I don't check in my preview so much anymore, like I mentioned, I do have a lot of like debugging utilities in my various projects that I work on. So a lot of like extensions with if debug around them that makes debugging simpler in certain ways, or it might make it simpler to create views or models and mock versions of them. And some people I know really don't like having that in their code base, that, you know, there's this debug only code in the code. But if it's a project that you're continuously working on and you have to do debugging and previewing and actually work on it, I think it makes a lot of sense to have debug utilities in the project that are, like you said, stripped out of release builds. So they're not in the App Store build at all, but they make your life easier as a developer because you have so many utilities at your disposal when you need to do common debugging tasks, whether those are related to like logging things or tracing things or like creating mock data, like mocking the network, whatever it might be that you often have to do or need to do to make your work more efficient. I think having those kinds of utilities in the project is a really big win.
Yeah, if you worry about that sort of thing ending up in release builds by accident, my suggestion would be to do what I do. I audit all of my builds, both beta and release builds. I used to have this habit of diffing iOS betas from one beta to the next and so forth. And
spelunking.
Exactly. So I spelunk my own app, basically, every time I have a build that I'm about to ship. I do like a diff of all the files and all of the strings and things like that, just to make sure that I didn't leave anything behind that shouldn't be there. And the trick I do with my poundif debugging code is most of like the really gnarly debug only things that should absolutely never be in release builds, they look kind of ugly because they start with underscore debug underscore. All of them have that prefix, so I can basically just grep for underscore debug underscore in my build, and if something was left behind accidentally, I will find it.
Yeah, and that's something when you do that naming scheme, it's quite easy also to write automated tools for that, right?
Right.
Where you could like have that in a debug folder in your project. So you could say, do like a search, like a grep or something, find all the references that match this string, like underscore, debug, underscore. And if it's outside of this folder, as I'm trying to do a release build, fail the build, right? Like that's also another kind of security or, you know, safety thing to not accidentally ship these things. So yeah, I agree. And as also isolating these things to a specific part of the code base, like a specific folder, specific files with extensions, with if debug at the start of the file and end if at the end of the file, to really make sure like you're not scattering these things across the project, to keep things organized still, I think is also really key.
Yeah.
All right, Rambo. So I think that's a good place to end this final episode of 2023. So all that remains is, first of all, to thank all of our dear listeners for listening to us this year. I know we haven't released as many episodes as we used to, but hope you did enjoy the episodes we did release. And we will continue to keep the show going in 2024. So please let us know on Mastodon, for example, on social media, what you think of our show these days, any specific topics you would like us to talk about. We're always open for these suggestions. It's always great to hear from our listeners. And then I also really want to thank you, Rambo, for our podcasting this year. Like I mentioned in the beginning, it's always so much fun to talk to you on the show. So really looking forward to keep the show going in 2024.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like doing the show with you. And also happy holidays, everyone, for those who celebrate.
Yeah, happy holidays and happy new year. And we will talk to you all again in 2024. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.